First of all, I'd like to say how wonderful this church is, where the bishops will sit for questions after the sermons. Thank you. This question is for Professor Van Dunn. It occurred to me that your talk implied that the non-aggression principle might not be sufficient for, or might be too idealistic for libertarians that lack a conscience or have a conscience different than others in their group to coexist peacefully or argue with each other because of the varying consciences of that. And I think you mentioned it, you know, so many words, the non-aggression principle alone isn't enough. And I just thought, do you see that the role of a third party arbitrator would have any effect in solving that problem, or how do you think that could be addressed?
The principle is not enough in the sense that you can repeat it a million times. If it is not received, if the people to whom you address it are not ready to receive it, to understand what you mean, then it is of course all in vain. That means that you expect the people to whom you address your non-aggression principle to be educated along certain lines, right? And the principle of education do not stop by repeating do not commit aggression. But you have to, cooperation is something else than not aggressing. And the constructive part is in the cooperation, the ways you cooperate in what you teach, for instance, your children. And the non-aggression principle is something that can be added whenever an enemy appears on the horizon. But normally, if the enemy is there before the friends are there, then nothing emerges at all. So everything that has to be defended rests on different principles than merely non-aggression.
Remember last year I talked about the bad neighbor problem, that you have people living next door to you and they have sex orgies that everybody can see, or let's say they engage in necrophilia, which is also a non-aggressive activity, or in incest or whatever, which is also a non-aggressive activity. So there is far more necessary than only saying no aggression defined in physical terms in order to have peaceful relationships between people living in close proximity with each other.
My question is for Professor Hopper. I haven't read Pinker, so I'm asking you whether Pinker deals with the problem of making things look better or worse according to the date from which you start your analysis, so that, for example, my financial advisor can show that my investments are doing very well just by choosing the date at which he starts. And does he deal with the fact that, for example, in the United States, it's been estimated that the homicide rate would be five times higher than it is if we used the same surgical and resuscitation techniques as in 1960? And then if you consider that in 1960, they'd already improved drastically. And by this means, you can show that the homicide attack rate in the United States has gone up by 100 times, if you believe the figures, has gone up 100 times since 1900. And at points in the 1970s, it was 200 times. Does he deal with that kind of problem? And what is the relevant point at which we compare our own lives with the past?
Yes, he does look at various historical periods in European and American societies and claims that the number of homicides sometimes goes up a little bit, sometimes goes down a little bit, but there is that the overall trend is, at least what he claims in according to his statistics, is that there's a clear decline of homicide rates, there's a clear decline of that is more pronounced in some societies, slightly less pronounced in others, but that is the overall trend in all societies which he for which he has collected data. Also, the number of hangings, for instance, so number of hangings goes down, the number of people subject to death penalty is going down. He does admit that in certain areas it also went up for a while, points out certain factors that have reduced it again. But his interest is to show long-run developments. I don't know if that answers your question or was your...
Well, it does answer the question about what Pinker does. I just dispute whether what he's saying is actually true and whether any sensible person would fail to worry that the homicidal attack rate had gone up enormously over the last 100 years by consoling himself that it's much better than it was in 4000 BC.
Again, you see, what I said was, I take his data as he presents them. I'm not competent enough to judge the validity of all the statistics that he gives. I try to show only that according to his own presented data, that does not make much sense. I have doubts about many of the data that he presents, but that would be an entirely different task for which I do not think I'm qualified to answer that, because that would require extensive historical research, and I'm not a historian.
Yeah, this is a question for Hoppe and either the other two, if you like. So it's about the ethics and their origins. So when you get to the bottom of libertarianism and Austrian economics, it comes down to the non-aggression principle, self-ownership, and where do you think ethics come from? Do they have a spiritual origin? You know, you touched on the Bible a little bit today. This is a matter of religion needs to address, but it still begs the question for me that isn't there a spiritual root to self-ownership and a right not to be invaded upon?
I think what Frank van Dunn has pointed out, the foundation is to be found somewhere in the fact that we argue with each other with the purpose of finding the truth, and of course we must be unified with other people by having a common conscience. But you begin with arguing one person with another person with a specific purpose in mind. We want to resolve an intellectual dispute by peaceful means.
Frank. Yes, there is. The principles as they are established afterwards, by after all this argumentation, they become detached from the arguments themselves. But you cannot do without the argumentation, and the argumentation has to move within fairly narrow bounds of propriety, because when blow to the head is enough to end the discussion. So in order to keep the discussion going and to keep faith in the results of arguing with one another alive, you have to have a certain spirit, and the spiritual attitude, right, moral attitude, if you will, has to be developed in the course of, because you cannot presume it given, but it has to be developed in the course of arguing itself. So that is why argumentation is probably the rarest of forms of exchange. I have distinguished it earlier from negotiation, from intimidation and so on, but I would also differentiate it from, for example, debates, right? Now, debates are plenty, they're everywhere, but the idea of a debate is totally different from that of an argumentation, because in a debate, typically the speakers are trying to persuade not the opponent, but the passive element, the audience or the judge, right? So the danger there is that they start playing on the judges or the audience's preferences or prejudices rather than responding to the opponent's arguments. So argumentation is very rare, and you will not find an argumentation-based morality throughout history. That's why most moral systems stay very close to a very small circle, or a rather small circle of people, the tribe, for example. And then the anathema, you are not to be one of us, is rather strictly interpreted according to tribal boundaries or to ethnic boundaries. But what we see in Western, of course there are other examples in the Far East, in the Western development of morality, is that there was this idea of the human person as such, right? Okay. Should put some flavor on it. So usually the argumentation is possible only with like-minded people. And the trick which was achieved in medieval Christianity, also already to some extent in Roman Christianity before that, was that the range of acceptable opponents in argumentation widened enormously. Well, you could see that, for example, in Anselm's decision to include the atheist as a possible person to argue with. Right? This was no longer a person you should avoid or even kill. You could sit down and try to convince him with reasons that he was wrong and that you were right.
Add something. I also think that this approach by argumentation is a very helpful and convincing approach. What I always like to do is to try to go even deeper and try to understand what is the phenomenon as a natural social phenomenon that discussions, argumentations about conflicts are going on. So this too is something to think about. And so I always think that, you know, when you ask as a lawyer or as a scientist in law, sometimes the question comes up, what is the law? What is it? Out of what is it made? Is it something a bit, according to you, questions that you catch from heaven, or comes it from inside, bottom up, or wherever does it come from? And I could imagine that a convincing answer or a consistent approach to this aspect is to look at the behavior of people in society. If conflicts happen, what happens out of a conflict? Some reactions come up. These are maybe just natural reactions. Actio equals reactio, things like that. And out of this maybe physical conflicts, reactions come out, shouting comes out, argumentation comes out, not in each individual situation, but as a cultural development. And so I can imagine that the ultimate basis of all these approaches, including argumentation, is the conflict as such. The conflict produces its own solution. It's a famous law scientist in Germany, Rudolf von Jhering, he put it very bluntly and said, law, this is revenge. Out of very archaic times, of course, this is a different kind of dealing with conflicts as we do, but in the very core of the phenomenon, it's the same. And I could imagine that there it's where you have to find, to search for the answer, what is law and where does it come from?
But I guess, you know, you can have an atheist could have a utilitarian argument for what, for morality or ethics, and I'm just, it still begs the question, though. I mean, even though if you arrive at an argumentation, it, you know, what is right or what is true, still, you know, you could come at it from a utilitarian way, but it would still beg the question of, like, why do people think that there are things that are right and wrong or true or untrue, or well, why is a violation of somebody wrong, you know? Why is the theft wrong? Like, it still begs the greater question of why, you know? Do you think there's more to it than just a
if I understand
utility,
you correctly, yeah. What you're looking for is that even this level of the question, so what is it, are these moral principles and what is this, the moral principle, and what is right and what is wrong, what is just and what is unjust, I think that is also something coming out of this conflict, of the argumentation, and is not the beginning of it, but is the end of it. Is the end of all what comes out of the conflict via these social interactions, and finally things like morals, like good, like bad, things like that emerge in society and become assets, become elements, become milestones within social interactions.
I don't think it is just conflict and there's a reaction to the conflict. In order to resolve the conflict, you can also resolve conflicts by intimidation. You can also resolve conflicts by using great rhetoric or whatever it is. No, the key is the conflicts have to be resolved by purely argumentative means. In that regard, I entirely agree with Frank. It is not, there's not some sort of automatic resolution of conflicts. Conflict breaks out, and then there's a reaction, and there's another reaction, then there's another reaction. At the end of this, the conflict is resolved. There must be a common conviction that only certain means are permissible in order to resolve in the conflict in such a way that it will be accepted by people as indeed a rational conflict resolution. So David tends to be, for my view, to be a little bit too naturalistic in this in this dispute, where we are more, yeah, can we say idealistic?
Yeah, in a certain sense, realistic, in the Platonic sense, realism. But I want about this conflict thing. Now, conflict, my own very childish and rudimentary analysis, conflict has a number of elements.
Microphone.
I'm sorry. A conflict has different parties, at least two, right? It has these parties have different views and purposes and goals. Hmm? There must be a common element. This is what Hans always stresses. The common element is the scarce thing, the what is at stake in the conflict. And the parties must have free or equal access to that scarce thing. If one of these elements is missing, then there is no conflict in a real sense. There is no clash of interest. So you always, whenever you have a conflict situation, you have four logical types of solutions. One is you reduce the number of parties to one, okay? Or you eliminate the differences of opinion. You create a consensus. So in the first case, you create unity out of plurality. In the second case, you create a consensus out of diversity. And you can also try to create differential access so that one party can no longer access the scarce means, which is the element of the conflict. And when these new conditions are established, the conflict disappears. It has no longer any ground. The fourth solution is you simply eliminate scarcity, right? That's the utopian solution. Yeah, the utopian solution. But the problem is, of course, when you have this philosophical analysis that allows four types of solution, and there is one conflict, you will have a conflict among the different solution providers. So one say, no, we need a unity, that is a society, an ordered arrangement in which this conflict will disappear. Another says, no, we need to build a consensus in which the differences of opinion will disappear. Another will say, no, we need a strict property regime, and the differences will, the conflict will disappear. And then the utopians will say, no, we need to make sure that everybody has plenty, right? But these are meta-conflicts. They can arise from any particular individual conflict. So they are not, a conflict is not a natural thing. It's basically in the minds. It starts from the minds of people. And the argument, finally, I would bring in Anselm here. You can think of conflicts in terms of magnitudes, that is clashing forces, or you can think of it in terms of principles, ethical positions. And of course, you can never get an ethical principle from a clash of forces. And that is the fallacy of Dawkins, that's the fallacy of Pinker, right? When he reduces violence to the measurable aspects of certain acts and not the intentional things.
I didn't quite understand, maybe I missed it, but why did we have the emergence of the state as the kind of global solution for the past 500 years? In other words, if we want to move from the state back to something like the Middle Ages, we need to really clearly understand why did we leave the Middle Ages. If that was a better social arrangement, why did that not last? And why did we, for now 500 years, have a worse solution? And you know, people like Stalin and Hitler maybe took advantage of the existing state, but they also moved it even further into the direction of monopoly and serving their own means. So what is it about the environment of the last 500 years that makes the state so resilient against a better social, like anarchic situation?
Maybe because it took a long time and only gradually occurred. A feudal king increasingly reaches a position of an absolute king, with some of the previous institutions still remaining in existence. And then you take the next step. To use an analogy, how did it happen that we have fiat currencies instead of hard metal? You can see that there's a tendency that will go in that direction, but they didn't do it instantly. First you start with coin clipping. Then the next step will be you monopolize the mining of gold. The next step is you permit that money substitutes will be introduced that are partially covered only by gold. You still have plenty of competition between different people who not mine but make really gold coins out of gold. Then you have the tendency of those people realizing you cannot inflate as much as you want as long as there exists competition between different people who offer gold as money. Then you have a central bank coming into existence, which allows all people to do coordinated inflation. Then you loosen that connection between money substitutes and genuine money, and finally you break the link entirely. So it was a long drawn out process, which maybe some people realized what their ultimate goal was. Most people didn't, but the next step was almost always clear that you had to take. So you take one step and then it follows almost logically what the next step must be. And I imagine that the process that we have, state formation out of a system that had no state, proceeded in a very similar, in a similar way, without any plan behind it, except those people who wanted to acquire this power knew always, this is the next step I have to take. And then the next generation is like, I know now what the next step has to be is this, in order to reach the ultimate goal.
Since I am seated on the left of Professor Hopper, I will answer slightly differently from what he did, because you asked about what brought the Middle Ages, which were moving in the right direction, what brought them to an end. And I think it has identifiable causes, and not just a drift, well-intentioned drift with dark sides that nobody appreciated, because the Middle Ages ended with dark sides all visible. And I think that the basic changes were the changes in weapons technology and the advancement of trade. Trade being a cause of great inequalities of wealth, which led to great inequalities in armaments, the ability to hire mercenaries and so on. So it was a a physical rearrangement of forces that broke the equilibrium, and the church was not able, even if she wanted to, maybe she did, maybe she didn't, she was not able to keep the new forces under control. For example, having authority over landlords is one thing, but having authority over rich traders is another thing, because they are constantly on the move and they are constantly making deals all over the place. They are negotiators, right? They are not arguers, traders. And then there was, of course, the bucolic plague, which was an enormous blow to the structure of the Middle Ages, because here was a problem, an enormous problem, caused apparently by nothing. So you had to say it was an act of God. But the Pope was absolutely ineffective against it, and the kings were ineffective against it. So the two pillars of the medieval order were, as it were, caught with their pants down, in a matter of speaking. And then there was the Byzantium, right? The Byzantine Empire that fell. And from the 1440s, you had a constant in-stream of refugees from the Byzantine borders. And these people were also very rich, and they brought an entirely new and astonishing culture with them, artistic skills that were unknown in the Middle Ages. So there was a fairly drastic change in the material conditions, and material conditions which nobody was able intellectually or materially to cope with. So a lot of things began moving around and falling. And let the chips fall where they may, well, that happened at that time. Now, of course, there were opportunities there, and unfortunately, whereas the plague struck high and low, the royal houses were the least struck of all, mostly. So the higher nobility was among the best placed to defend itself against the plague, and they were also, together with the merchants, they had the wherewithal to buy all the empty estates that were available, because the people there had died. So there was an enormous rearrangement of political and economic power at the time.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything. I don't know why you said sitting to the left of me, as if that had some meaning. I don't think it.
I liked very much Professor Dürr's presentation, and he put on the timeline the ascending power of state idolatry and the descending power of the Catholic Church. A few remarks. The first one is that the power of the state is limited only by competing powers of other states, or by the resistance or the counter violence of the people oppressed by a state. The power of the church is rooted in a divine order. That means that it is always limited, because it has to refer to this to the divine order. It cannot get out of control. And this is one aspect which has a lot of consequences. For instance, if we look at the election results in Germany in the 30s, you will see that in the Catholic countries of in the Catholic Länder of Germany, the percentage of people who voted for the Nazi Party was much lower than in the Protestant parts of the country, because the identification with the state, together with the missing link to Rome, created another situation which was much more favorable for a totalitarian state. Second element is punishment. The state, if you want to leave the state, you are punished immediately. So they create the hell on earth. The punishment of the cat of the church also exists. It's a little bit delayed. Yeah, you will probably end in hell, but nobody has seen there really how it is. So it's delayed, and you have no sanctions to fear on earth. The third point is, which is I think particularly interesting because it's mostly misunderstood, and that's the dogma of the infallibility of the Pope. What does it mean? It's generally interpreted as an expansion of the power of the Pope. But in reality, it's quite the contrary. It put extreme limits to every Pope, because this infallibility is also in history. That means every Pope who said something in ex cathedra cannot be contradicted by another Pope afterwards. And that's probably one of the reasons, I think, that that this is one of the reasons why the Catholic Church still exists, while all other Protestant church simply transformed in some kind of humanistic associations without, okay, we don't talk about it. But in the Catholic Church, it's a wall against modernism. And I think it was the most important contribution in the dogmatic and doctrinal development of the Catholic Church was particularly this decision by Pius the Ninth. Imagine if we had not the infallibility of the Pope. Imagine that Bergoglio could do what he wants. Imagine what the outcome of that. We would probably already have a female Pope, probably lesbian. We would venerate God as Mother Earth. We would probably had Corpus Christi on the same day as the Christopher Street Parade. Yeah? And we would have a Catholic Church with no difference to every other of the churches who exists and who are completely victimized by modernization.
Thank you. Yes, these are interesting additions. I can follow all your thoughts. To take one point, you put in the first and in the third argument is the relation between church and power. You said they legitimate their power from God, while states legitimate the power from elsewhere, democracy or state itself, whatever. I think the most important aspect in this ambiguity between these two kinds of legitimation is not how is the power legitimized, but who has the power effectively. I mean, I could imagine that the fact that the church made out of this papal infallibility not a regime to dominate, you know, the world, but a regime to make the own faith, the own system of morals more consistent, more convincing perhaps for those that believe in it. So this approach to these legitimations was chosen not voluntarily, but because they did not have the power anymore. I could imagine that with the same dogmas, the church would have acted differently 300 years earlier when they had the power. So I think this is a very important aspect, while the state who took over, so to speak, the power, which was sort of, you know, secularization of the old church power into secular structures, there they found any legitimations, these states, to enforce their power. They had the power, and the reason that legitimation is not that important anymore. They can argue with democracy, we know that God failed, or they can argue with, you know, natural law or the state as such, as the fascists did, the remark you told me before, quite explicitly. Maybe it's not that important. Much more important is that they had the power.
Professor Hopper, you made passing mention of Hobbes, and I know that you've gone into further treatment on the Hobbesian myth. I'm wondering if you would summarize Pinker's work, operating out of his depth as he was, is just an empirical repackaging of Hobbes, and if so, if you could offer a further method or silver bullet to drive a stake through that Hobbesian myth.
I think Pinker is even worse than Hobbes, because Hobbes does leave open the possibility that people can throw off the state if the state doesn't do what it is supposed to do. Pinker doesn't even has this aspect, that at any point that there might be a point coming where you have to throw off this. There are many contradictions in Pinker. For instance, the American secession from England, he somehow finds good, even though that is obviously a resistance against a state. That contradicts his central thesis. The guy writes in a way that he has a way to wiggle himself out of any type of objection that you make, because he always hedges this way and then he hedges this way. So what I try to do here was to reduce the entire book to the bare essentials. And I'm sure that if Pinker would read something like this, but I also say this, and I also say this. He can only do this if he just simply forgets about what his central thesis is. Hedging your bets, I think he is quite good at that, to avoid any type of criticism. But again, in that regard, he is worse than whatever Hobbes says, because Hobbes does leave open the possibility, if the state doesn't do it, you are entitled to throw it over and go back to state of nature.
I'd like to draw an unlikely comparison between two strange travel companions, meaning Martin Luther and Machiavelli. And I'm thinking about the sola gratia principle and the prince. On one side, the Lutheran principle legitimates the existing order and the existing princes who broke free from the medieval order of the Pope and the Emperor. And on the other side, Machiavelli is the author of the definite separation between morals and states. The prince has to pursue only power, and it's irrelevant if he acts morally or not, or even more, he should act immorally because this furthers the power of the state. What do you think about these two thinkers as at the beginning of modern states?
Well, there are certain similarities, and there are also very obvious differences. And the difference is that Machiavelli was not someone who denied the possibility of moral truth. Right? He simply said, or his main message, if you will, was that it does not weigh heavily enough in the decision-making of princes to play a role. But he was not saying what Luther was saying, that it is impossible for human reason to come to any reasoned judgment about right or wrong. These qualities are certainly possible, but they are not effective in, note this, not just in politics, but in a competitive political environment. because that is the point of the prince. The Machiavellian prince is a competitor. He is not a ruler from the ruling house, the 17th in a row, secure on the throne. No, he's somebody who has to acquire power and maintain it. So his whole thinking is that of a entrepreneur, so to speak, in a market, rather than that of a ruler who has to sit tight and quiet and rule, that is, judge, and be the judge and be the protector of the realm. But the Machiavellian prince has to make power, and he has to use it to, and that is the great difference, I think, with the medieval scheme, he has to use it to govern. Because medieval rulers did not govern. They ruled, but they didn't govern, right? And this was in the 19th century, French liberals picked it up. Le roi gouverne, le roi règne, mais ne gouverne pas. This difference between ruling and governing. But if you now go to Luther, for him there is no possibility for corrupt human reason to find principles of right and wrong. So the secular replacements are power and wealth. Right? Power and wealth rule, and the only way in which morality enters is through the Bible. But the Bible does not change anything, except it adds a few words to the human situation, but it does not change the dynamic of the human situation. And both Luther and Machiavelli were opposed by the Catholic Church, which held the notion that it was possible, since human beings are persons and persons are minded bodies or embodied minds, it is possible for persons to act according to ideas, consequently also according to the right ideas. And this was a moral duty, therefore, a perfect duty to do right. And this was missing both in Machiavelli and in Luther.
Well, this is a question to the panel going into the future now. So obviously state is accumulating more and more power. And looking back, there is a dynamic that probably could not be foreseen. The same applies for the future. But one thing should be sure, that this accumulation of power of the state, as you showed, will come to an end, because there is probably just one law that there will be change. So there is not just to be thought of more of the same. Of course, we can now prolong this in the future. It will continue to accumulate power. It will be richer. It will be more powerful. People will become more cursed or poorer, but this will come to an end. Can the panel comment on scenarios, how it will come to an end, and have a very patient outlook to the future, as we are all sharing very low time preference?
I think the two most likely scenarios are, the one is we have to radically decentralize. All these global systems will fall apart due to internal rivalries, which are even promoted nowadays, in particular through the immigration policy, making societies more and more heterogeneous, creating more and more conflicts. One way out of that is, of course, the separation of different smaller units that do it their way. The other scenario that I see is likely is that we have, that we will get a hardcore dictatorship. Once the problems that exist in the current societies, like paying for pensions, all the free goodies that the welfare state has promised, that cannot be done, that you then have to resort to truly violent measures, even in the Pinker sense, violence. So dictatorship, I think, is one possibility, and the other one is, if you want to avoid that, would be decentralization, secession, breaking up of states. That's what I see as the two most likely scenarios. And I hope, of course, for the decentralization solution, and fear that the dictatorship solution is a very real possibility.
I would like to add perhaps another scenario too, which goes a bit in that direction of that dictatorship. It is, you know, the world state. It's just, or maybe that was your idea, not national or European or something like that dictatorship, but world dictatorship. I think that when you ask how, when you say it will come to an end, I would also think that, I mean, dinosaurs also came to an end. So that this tendency will come to an end. So there are in principle two variants. It comes to an end in the direction of decentralization, that this tendency toward monopolization of power would stop, would fall apart, would die of some virus, some libertarian virus. But I think it's also possible that it will come to this apocalyptic scenario of a world state. I think there are many, many signs that show in that direction. Not this conference, of course, but many other signs. And I would say it's not unrealistic that this scenario happens. It's not very promising, but I would say not impossible. And at the very least, it's necessary to keep that in mind, to be aware that this is a very dramatic situation in which we are. And once we want to take some influence by conferences like that, by you know, making this kind of thinking and of communication and so on, that we have this danger. And so it's really something to do. I could, with this general view, imagine that it's almost impossible to define a program and say, okay, let's make this or that in order to try to change this history. Maybe these are that important elements of human evolution that actually one cannot influence them really, but only look at them, try to give some, you know, kick in this or that way, try to support tendencies if there are tendencies in that decentralized direction. But finally, it could be that, you know, in 1,000 years at another conference, they look back and say, oh, that was fine. And ultimately, it didn't go that wrong as one thought it could go. Suddenly, this libertarian virus went everywhere and these big structures fell apart. Maybe it's like that, and I would, of course, very much welcome it.
Of course, I see a tendency to create a world state, but I think that is not in the short and intermediate run. I don't think that will happen. And if it happens, then it will also by ultimate violence, and there has to be some sort of super dictator who brings it brings it about. You first have to destroy all sorts of nationalist, regional affiliations in attitudes among people. Yes, they try. I mean, I see the European development in this way, that they nationalism might have been a bad thing in the 19th century, and nations were partly created also by conducting war. In this day and age, nationalism is actually a good force, in my view, because it prevents this tendency to create a world state or ever larger states. And those people who want to bring about a world state, and there are, of course, organizations with mighty people who work in that direction, what they do is, of course, try to destroy all regional affiliations, all national affiliations, by creating artificial heterogeneity in Europe. I think this importing all of these people from strange places into Europe is, of course, a way to eliminate, let's see, the feeling of Germans. We are Germans. We are not. We have something to do with other countries in Europe, but still we are Germans. We do not want to be run by Brussels. The more heterogeneous societies become, the easier it is to centralize. But the centralization also needs dictatorial powers. So I still think that I perfectly agree that there is this tendency, and that is a long-run possibility that might happen. But in the short run, I think the alternatives will be either there will be decentralization or there will be dictatorship.
Well, I do not have a separate or even blacker scenario, but I would like to add to the hopefulness that comes out of decentralization, I would add the question, what does decentralization mean in the age of Facebook and Twitter and things like that, where the institutional decentralization may be complete, yet the thinking could be not more uniform than if it had been a completely institutionalized centralization. So even institutional decentralization in an age of ultra-fast communication of nonsense and wrong-headed ideas may not be of great help. But I'm a pessimist.
I've got a brief question to Professor Van Dunn. I wonder if you could comment in a bit more depth than you managed. I know your text goes into a bit more depth, but on the reintroduction of Aristotle and the around the height of late Middle Ages and the effect that that had on Western thought.
Yeah, well, I did not go into that at length in my lecture, but I think that's an important thing, and it's of course a vital question, considering that Catholicism, when you talk about Catholicism, people never seem to go back beyond Thomas Aquinas. Of course, there was a lot before Thomas Aquinas, but what he did, apart from being a wonderful genius of a man, and what he produced in a very short time, he did so in a rather limited philosophical way. That is, he married Christianity to Aristotelianism, and Aristotelianism does not really lend itself, in my view, to a Christianization project. The reason, which I mentioned, I believe, was that if nature, all of nature, everything moves towards its end, from the inside. Why do you need a church and why do you need a Christ? Because these are the people who show the way. They are the, and they would be irrelevant if the way was always, as it were, built in. If everyone had his own GPS system and automatic steering towards the goal to be reached. So the idea of Christianity as Thomistic Christianity, in my view, severely weakened the church not very long after Thomas, with his Aristotelian ideas, was accepted as a positive, genius contribution to the church, because he died in the 1270s, right? And he and the plague struck about 60 years after. The plague was 1348, I believe. So in that short period when Aristotelianism was being established as the official, not yet quite official, but as the strong contender for the doctrinal identity of the church, an event occurred that made it very delicate for the church to accept Aristotelianism, because suddenly now this was part of providence. This plague, this disaster, was a providential act. It was no longer something in nature that Christians would have to cope with. No, it was a providential act. And I think that was a very difficult thing to explain to people who have lost all their relatives and all their belongings. And a lot of theological energy went into explaining that these things are really at bottom, but in ways that we do not understand, good. Because Aristotelian ideas, everything is good. The previous theology, the Anselmic theology, was not everything is good. That doesn't mean nature is bad, but nature is neutral. Right? And things can happen in the family, in nature, in the woods, in the water, in the sky, which have no moral significance, but you have to cope with them as moral beings. So there you have the pinpointing of the fortitude or the Christian meekness, the ability to stand up to whatever happens, lies with man. Right? It is not some sort of divine scenario in which the good things will be revealed at the end. Meanwhile, millions of people die within a couple of months, but it's okay.
So first of all, I very much agree with your analysis of the evil that the state represents. And there are very few people in the libertarian movement who can criticize the state as pointedly as you do. But how would we, or how would you ensure that the state won't reemerge once we've managed to abolish it? Because I'm specifically thinking of the high numbers of psychopaths and narcissists in executive positions in all sorts of organizations in society. So just to give you a number, 21% of all CEOs are like a recent study showed, are psychopaths or have personality disorders, as compared to only like 2 to 3% of the general population. And so these people are simply much more functional and capable to handle high pressure situations and stress than us normal people, but they're also willing to stop at nothing if necessary. So wouldn't these people simply gather and through some sort of secret society or collusion take advantage of us normal people again? And wouldn't that bring back another evil rule again over time? So how would a private libertarian community protect itself against such sociopaths that have obviously been ruling the world for centuries now? And isn't the competition of crooks, the Wettbewerb der Gauner, like you call it, isn't that a much larger problem than just within politics?
I think there is no guarantee that such a thing will happen. But at least, to use one of the phrases of Mary Ross, but at least we might have had a glorious holiday. And in the end, we get that again. Also these small communities that I mentioned, for instance, yes, of course, they have to protect themselves too, and the protection cannot always occur only with the people involved in these community alone. You must also have alliances with similar thinking communities, arrangements that you help each other, something that we can learn in a way from the Middle Ages without imitating that exactly. There existed, of course, all sorts of alliances, but overlapping alliances. Some people were aligned with that, some people were aligned with that. They were aligned again with a third party or a fourth party and so forth, which makes it very difficult to create powerful enough opponents of a free society to eliminate them. So forming alliances that might be not neighboring communities, but maybe distant ones, would be a way to reduce this danger. There is no clear-cut recipe how you can eliminate this danger totally. That is part of mankind with which we have to live, but as I said, it might work for a while, and that might be worth it. And in the end, we get something again like we have right now. But to say that because that danger exists, we rather stay with the current situation, that seems to be a strange answer. That is like committing suicide because you are afraid of dying later on.